This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we begin today on a small wooden boat in the southwest of France. And there, a young boy named Anthony Bourdain ate his first oyster.
But I, in the proudest moment of my young life, stood up smartly, grinning with defiance, and volunteered to be the first. And with one bite and a slurp, wolfed it down. It tasted of seawater, of brine and flesh, and somehow of the future. My parents' shudders, my little brother's expression of unrestrained revulsion and amazement only reinforced the sense that I had somehow become a man. I'd learned something. Food had power. It could inspire, astonish, shock, excite, delight, and impress. It had the power to please me and others.
Those are excerpts of the late Anthony Bourdain reading the audio version of his 2000 best-selling book, Kitchen Confidential, and he would later cite that experience as the start of his quest to become a chef. Food does have power, as Bourdain writes, and it turns out there are a lot of ingredients out there that push us all to love or hate, like oysters. And in this new series, we are setting out to rehabilitate those reviled ingredients with a better understanding, freshness, local creativity. Can we turn ick to yummy? We're going to try it today with oysters. Jeremy Sewell is chef and owner of Row 34 with locations in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. Nancy Batista Caswell is owner of Caswell Restaurant Group, including Brine Oyster Bar in Newburyport. Jeremy, welcome.
Thank you.
Nancy, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
We also have a guest taster here, former Oyster Bar employee and producer of the only other segment where I have eaten an oyster on air. WBUR's Walter Wuthman is here as well. Hey there, Walt.
Hey, Tiziana.
And I should note, there are listeners out there going, what do you mean reviled? I love oysters. Right. Love or hate? So going to acknowledge you. And we're going to learn all of the wonderful ways that you can serve oyster. But I want to start with a lightning round. So, Jeremy, raw or cooked?
Raw.
Nancy, favorite oyster dish?
I love fried oysters.
Best variety?
Anything coming out of Duxbury or Barnstable.
I would agree. Anything coming out of the Cape, yeah.
True or false, only eat oysters in months that end in R?
That's false.
Yeah, false.
All right. And circling back to Kitchen Confidential and Bourdain, he writes that you shouldn't order fish at restaurants on Mondays. True or false? Mm.
I think that's false.
Yeah, I'd say false too.
But sorry, go ahead.
No, I mean, obviously our opinion is jaded. We serve great fish on Monday as we do every other day. Yeah.
The old saw is that the order might not have been placed since the previous Thursday. And so on Monday, you might not be getting the freshest fish. Mm. Of course, the two of you are like, of course, in my restaurant, you're going to get the freshest fish. Okay, so here's what we're going to do today. We are going to take this dish. We're going to try some different ways to prepare it. We're going to learn about the history of oysters, the myths about oysters, their role regionally, et cetera. And we're going to start, Jeremy, with raw oysters, with classic condiments, which you brought in. All of us can taste them. Why don't you tell us what you've got here?
So these are Row 34 oysters. These are grown in Duxbury. This is just a really unique oyster that is grown specifically in cages, and they never touch the bottom, and they're touched a lot, so they end up being a beautiful shape and a nice cup. And they're really just a delicious, briny, great example of a perfect East Coast oyster.
Why does touching them a lot matter?
Well, if you touch them, if you just put them on the bottom, they're going to grow. Or if you leave them alone, they're going to grow. But they're going to grow out. If you touch them and turn them and keep chipping away the edges, they'll grow deep. And sometimes
so
you want that
thicker
nice
flesh.
You want that deep cup, you know, so it's just that kind of, you know, for lack of a better term, we say eyeball quality, where there's just this beautiful lump of oyster sitting in a deep cup.
Okay, for those who are anxious about raw oyster texture, you are not selling it with
okay.
a phrase like eyeball quality.
You got to get over it.
Now, Walt, do you already like raw oysters?
I love raw oysters.
Okay, so what are on these,
Jeremy? I did not do condiments. We're doing straight lemon.
Straight lemon.
And this is really the purest form of eating an oyster. This is how you should eat an oyster. Your first oyster should be just slurped back with a little lemon on it. And I always love to say that everyone remembers their first oyster. Everyone remembers the first time they ate an oyster and where they ate it. And, you know, Bourdain put it beautifully, but I think we all have a similar story of our first oyster.
Okay, so Walt and I are going to taste them. Nancy, you go ahead and taste now while I take mine. Walt, do you remember your first oyster?
That's funny. Yeah, I actually do, and I didn't realize I remembered it, but it was at my aunt's, I think, 40th birthday party in San Francisco. and her friends grilled oysters out on this little charcoal grill in the rain.
Mm, yeah.
And I remember watching it, and I'm like, that looks really cool. I was really young, but and then they gave me one, and I tried it, and it was amazing.
Okay, so Nancy, I'm going to try this, and while I do, tell me how to eat it,
yeah,
and if there's an etiquette to eating a raw oyster.
Well, that's the interesting part, certainly, when someone's trying the oyster. It's kind of getting over the anxiety of, how do I eat the oyster? Do I slurp it? Do I chew it? You know, how do I sauce it? Like, what if I don't like it, right?
I did the just texture. Slurp and chew,
yeah,
not going to lie.
Right. And it's important to do that, you know, and obviously, like Jeremy was saying, the cup is perfect on this, and of course, Jeremy's a pro, so the belly was shucked and completely detached from the shell, which makes it very easy to just bring the shell right to your mouth and enjoy the little bit of brine that was also still present to give it that perfect saltiness.
So, Jeremy, while I ask you to pass me a napkin for the little bit of brine that's on my hands, I was surprised. It really was just, for me, lemon and fresh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you know, when you're cooking in general, salt and acid are the two things you want to use the most. And when you just add acid and there's already that brininess of that oyster, they just, you know, combine for that perfect kind of burst of flavor in your mouth. And it's fresh and bright and delicious, makes your mouth water, makes you want another one. And that's the beauty of oysters.
And Walt, did it taste like you want a raw oyster to taste?
Yes. Yeah, like a little bite of the ocean.
Yes. Yeah.
There you Wonderful. Go. Although it was less oceany, Nancy, than one who, my first oyster on Radio Boston.
Yeah.
Right? Recently, within the last 3.5 years. So I'm still a little afraid that's going to taste like ocean.
Yeah.
Right? But this, the right amount of ocean.
Yeah. And, you know, if you taste an oyster, especially this time of year, I mean, winter is a great time to be eating oysters. A lot of people, especially in New England, tend to think that summertime is the time just because it's obviously beautiful out. But appreciating a good oyster and having it in the winter coming out of cold water is just, it's perfect. And it's going to produce what we just had, which is a nice, clean, mild brine. Easy oyster.
And with wild oysters, the thought was only those R months, because in the summer, both there may be more bacteria, but also because they're spawning. And so the flavor is not as good because the physicality of the oyster changes. Is that right, Jeremy?
That's right. And that's pretty typical historically, where the water warms up, oysters spawn, all their energy goes into spawning. The flesh isn't, you know, kind of soft and mushy and not very good. But, you know, as we've gotten better at growing a lot of things, they've bred that out of the oysters. So the farmed oysters don't have that moment where they spawn.
Okay, so Nancy, you're going to give us our first cooked dish now, right? This
right.
is a baked oyster. And is this a farm-raised oyster as well?
Yeah, these guys from Island Creek are doing our oysters too. This one particularly is the Moon Shoals coming out of a Barnstable. As
okay.
you can see, similar to what Jeremy was saying, this cup is a little bit more deeper. Of course, the belly
is
a little larger.
This is a big shell, right?
Yeah.
With a lot of oyster. I picture oysters as being itty bitty bits of meat in a shell, but this is substantial.
And it's perfect because if you think about it, the vessel itself is the perfect for baking.
We're reaching across the table while Nancy talks to give me a baked oyster here. So, okay, go ahead.
The cup itself is perfect for holding the ingredients. And what we did today was a bechamel, which is just like a butter sauce. And I always think it's important to think about a new diner, somebody trying oysters for the first time, to think about something more nostalgic, something they're familiar with, something mm-hmm. that they might identify with, like, oh, I love that, so I'd be willing to try an oyster. And in this particular,
I like baked fish with
yeah.
butter.
Yeah, and so this butter, and then we're finishing it with fresh black truffles, which, of course, who doesn't love black truffles? And it's an easy prep. You shuck them, you put them in the oven. You can bake them, you can broil them for 5-7 minutes, and they're just delightful.
Okay, so no slurping here. I'm going to use a spoon.
Yeah.
While I do, tell us more, Jeremy, about who grows oysters here, farmed oysters, and why Duxbury seems to be a place for that.
Well, you know, almost every state on the East Coast grows oysters, and it is absolutely one of the largest growing segments of aquaculture in this country. Maine has more coastline than anywhere, and actually probably more coastline than anywhere else in the United States with all the islands. Oyster permitting and growing up there has gone tenfold over the last 10 years. Massachusetts does an amazing job. Duxbury has a great environment, you know, where it has a ton of water coming in and a ton of water going out every tide. So that fresh water coming in from the ocean washes over those oysters every tide a couple times a day, which is beautiful.
It helps them get thicker.
Yeah, it helps
and
everything.
It keeps them fresh.
Yeah, it keeps them fresh. It feeds them all the new nutrients coming in the water that they feed on. It's a great environmental story. There's, you know, little to no impact on the environment. It's actually positive for the environment. They filter a lot of stuff out of the water that shouldn't be there, which they filter well enough that it's not really harmful to humans. We manage it much better than we ever did. The state and oyster farmers do a great job communicating and testing water throughout the year to make sure that they're harvesting safe oysters. And it's been a great way for people to make a living on the waterfront who've had to give up certain things. Like catching wild fish for a living is really difficult to do. It's not the same as it was 20, 30 years ago. So people have been able to transfer over to aquaculture and oyster farming as a way of life.
So we're learning ways to prepare oysters for everyone to love them. We have Jeremy Sewell from Row 34 and Nancy Batista Caswell from Brian Oyster Bar in Newburyport here. Guest taster Walter Withman, you just tasted Nancy's baked oyster. Tell me what you tasted.
Really good. So it's the oyster sitting in that really delicious cream sauce. It's almost like an elevated clam chowder.
Yeah.
Just one like perfect bite. Really good.
Well, and it's important also to think about the oyster is like you're going to see in Jeremy's butter, I'm sure, without even diving in. Using it as a component or ingredient use it for its saltiness, right? Let it serve a purpose on the dish too. It's really welcoming.
And now you mentioned the word butter, which always catches my attention. Mm-hmm. And Jeremy, you made an oyster-infused butter. Is that hard? I mean, that sounds like mm-hmm.
I'm going to say no.
He's a pro.
Yeah.
Would it be hard for me?
No. I mean, it's maybe not the simplest thing in the world to do, but it's not the hardest either. It's a recipe in the Row 34 cookbook that came out last year that we started trying to teach people how to do oysters in lots of different ways. And this is, we took oysters and hot smoked. It means you cook the oyster as you smoke it, and then we whipped it into butter. And you have the smoked oyster butter.
So you take butter and you put the oysters in and you whip it all up.
Yep.
Okay.
It's not that hard. The hard part is finding the right oyster and smoking
it. And what's the seasoning in green
on top? So we just put it on a little toasted baguette and some fresh herbs, Aleppo pepper, sea salt, lemon, and just, you know.
All right. So I'm taking first taste here while we pass these around.
Thank you.
And while we do, Jeremy and Nancy, when we do Brewed in Massachusetts, which is our series on the brewing industry, mm-hmm. we discover, and I love the sound of everyone crunching. I can't wait to take my turn. We discover that it's a good, tight community, lots of sharing ideas. Do the two of you, and do you have a local chef, seafood chef community where you're sharing ideas, you know and support each other's businesses? Nancy, tell me a little bit about that.
I think so. I mean, there's certainly that energy amongst each other. And when we're using familiar oyster farmers like the guys at Island Creek, they definitely communicate quite a bit. One of our oysters, the oyster in the pot pie, is actually from Unicorn Oyster, these guys up in Maine that are diving into oyster farming for the first time in quite some time, a couple of years now they've been in it. But I think that they also kind of bring that synergy and connection amongst each other and knowing where their oysters are and what people are doing with it. And of course, social media plays a big part of it now with what we're seeing people doing.
So Jeremy, oh my God, the smoke, the salt, the crunch.
Who knew?
Put it up, right?
Yeah.
Right? Now, I wouldn't use a lot, right? It is a strong butter.
It is. And it's a little bit on there, and you get the crunch and the salt and a little bit of spice from the pepper and the lemon and the herbs. It all just works for a few bites. I mean, the beautiful thing about this butter is you can put it on toast. You can put it in your pasta. Whatever you could do with butter, you can add this to it.
What would I drink with this? A soda, a club soda, a wine, a
white
beer.
Wine.
Yeah, like white wine.
You think white wine.
Yeah, or a really hoppy beer would be great with this, you know, or a nice crisp white wine. Mm-hmm. You can't go wrong.
Yeah.
I'm still chewing. You keep talking, man.
Yeah, I would agree. Something like from Burgundy, like a Chablis or something really clean, not a whole lot of oak, maybe not something like a domestic Chardonnay per se, but it's lovely and agree with Jeremy on a beer.
Now, Nancy, you brought us a pot pie, mm-hmm. an oyster pot pie. Mm-hmm. And in a minute, I'm going to ask you about the ingredients. Maybe we can start passing that around with some spoons so we'll be able to taste mm-hmm. it. One of the things that strikes me about a pot pie, it makes me think of shepherd's pie. Not only are these traditional foods, but they were a working person's food. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I think makes people shy away from oysters is expensive. Mm-hmm. So can one enjoy oysters if one's really on a budget? Can you do this affordably?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, especially if you're looking for, dishes that are composed, you might feel like you're getting a little bit more bang for your buck or substance. But some people will say like, oh, I'm hungry and a dozen oysters isn't going to fill me up. But that's not necessarily the case. If they're big, larger oysters, you're certainly going to feel like you're full. But in this particular case, yeah, we went with the pot pie. Again, that nostalgic opportunity to introduce something that people grew up knowing or preparing in their home. And, you know, often we also think about, I think Walt mentioned, you know, chowder. We think about the New England clam chowder. So fun kind of play on also introducing oysters. And in the ingredients, we've got bacon. Who doesn't love bacon? Which sure. gives it that smokiness quality as well. And it's got mushrooms in it. It's got a little shishito pepper. And we finished it with a very light puff pastry.
So Jeremy's taking first taste here. So while Walt and I taste, Jeremy, tell us what you get.
It's delicious. Absolutely. I mean, you definitely get the umami from the oyster kind of being cooked.
Oh my God.
In there. And
keep going.
Mm-hmm.
And the smoke from the bacon. I mean, it's great.
Yeah. This, honestly, Nancy, Walt, do you taste the oyster?
You're going to have to come back to me.
Oh, got it. I feel like I'm really tasting pot pie.
Mm. Yeah.
Right? I taste the bacon. I taste the onion. I taste the shell. I feel like this is sneaky oyster.
Yeah. In the particular case, we were also playing with doing a whole belly. So you got that whole big pop of oyster right in your mouth. But then we also talked about chopping it so it kind of evenly came through. But again, just going back to using the oyster as a version of a nice kind of salt salinity pop that's... gives you that brightness.
Now, well, it's like, I'm ready.
Well, one, it's really delicious. Two, I have a question. I've heard that the Maine oysters are actually saltier because the water's colder. They grow slower.
Yeah.
Is that true?
That is true.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Not every one of them, but is a wide kind of look at a Maine oyster. Colder water, more time in the water.
Okay.
Tend to so be
putting a Maine oyster in here, you're getting like a lot of natural salt.
Yeah.
All right. So last question for you, and I'm going to unbreak... finish this. Last question. So somebody says, fine, I'm convinced. I'm going to try cooking an oyster. 2-3 quick. Jeremy, give me one. When you're going to buy oyster, make sure you...
Know how long they've been out of the water when they were harvested. There's tags that come with them. Anyone who's selling you oysters should be able to tell you where they're from, when they were harvested, and just make sure that, you know, you get oysters that are probably a week or less old out of the water.
Mm-hmm. And once you've got them, Nancy, how long do you have to cook them?
You know, depending on how you're holding them and maintaining them in your refrigerator, but honestly, you know, the fresher the better. You know, give it a couple days.
All right. Nancy Batista Caswell, owner of Caswell Restaurant Group and Brine Oyster Bar in Newburyport, is one of those. Jeremy Sewell, chef, and owner of Row 34.
Too.
Yeah, all of the above. Yeah. Walter Wuthman from WBUR. Thanks to all three of you. Delicious.
Thank you. Thank you, chefs.
You.
From Boston Harbor we set sail. The wind was a blowing the devil of a gale. With the ringtail set.
And now to another fish in the sea. Okay, well, actually, this one's at the State House, not in the sea. Massachusetts has some unique maritime traditions, from Gloucester's greased pole to Provincetown's blessing of the fleet to Boston, where last week a wooden fish made its way from the old State House to the new State House.
There it is.
Sound there of the procession from State Representative Lindsay Sabados's Twitter. Now, if you listen closely there in the background, you could hear folks chanting, codfish, codfish. And the codfish they're chanting about is the sacred cod. It hangs above the Massachusetts chamber for the House of Representatives. And here with us to explain the history, the storied history of the sacred cod, none other than WBUR senior State House reporter Steve Brown.
It's more like a legend. The fish, not me.
The legend Steve Brown is going to tell us. You and I have been talking about you telling us the legend of the sacred cod for years
and
now.
And finally we're going to do it.
All right, so we're going to start with a quick round of true or false.
Uh-oh.
All right, so true or false, the sacred cod that was paraded from the old State House to the new State House is the original sacred cod.
Nope.
Okay. An iteration of the sacred cod was stolen or kidnapped by members of the Harvard Lampoon.
That's true, and that's one group that stole it.
So there's been more than one.
Oh, yeah.
Stinkers. The holy mackerel is the same as the sacred cod.
Nope.
Okay, and scrod stands for sacred cod.
I don't think so.
Maybe, I think, is the answer on that one. All right, so let's pick it up from there. Why do we have a sacred cod, Steve?
it, as you say, hangs in the House chamber, and it's an homage to the fishing industry, which was so key to the Massachusetts economy back in the 1700s. It was so key that they felt, you know, we need to honor that. And the fishing industry is still a big thing here in Massachusetts, maybe not as big as it was back then, but, you know, you have New Bedford, you have Chatham, you have Gloucester.
We have a whole Cape named after it.
We have, exactly. So the cod is revered here in Massachusetts, not to take the name of another historical figure there, but it is honored, and the Massachusetts legislature has chosen to do so.
Now, we have other products from the sea, for example, lobster that we know we associate, corn on land. What was it in the early days about the cod in particular?
I think it was so plentiful. And that's one of the things that I'm hearing now is that, you know, you go fishing off Cape Cod, it's unusual when you catch a cod. So it was so omnipresent back in the 1700s that it was everywhere. And that was the main staple
at
that time.
So let's stay now, Steve, with this idea of omnipresent, because so now we have this sculpture
mm-hmm.
of a cod, a big sculpture.
It's wooden. It's a little bit larger than life size.
Yeah. And we're in our third iteration of that.
That's right. The first one hung in the old state house. And I guess it burned, the old state house burned in 1747, and the wooden cod burned with it.
Pretty much everything.
Everything. They put a second one up, and then you have this thing, the Revolution, and the Redcoats supposedly took it, and I don't know what they did with it, but...
So let's stop there for a second, because I have two questions you may or may not know the answer to. It is true that it seems nobody knows for sure that the British took it, but are assuming, and mm-hmm. nobody knows what happened
right.
to it. Was there a nefarious fire in 1747, or was it just an accident? We know?
I don't know that for sure. It was early on. We were still a colony. Things were made of wood. We lit with gas lights.
And we had very little fire.
And exactly. Yeah. So there were a lot more fires were much more common back then than they are now, thankfully.
Okay. And this is another thing that I learned in this, which is that during the Revolutionary War, and of course the state house then probably technically wasn't a state house because we were still a colony.
Right. I guess they call it the townhouse.
But the British soldiers actually boarded in the building at one point during the Siege of Boston, I believe.
Right. Prior to independence, Massachusetts was a colony, and the governor was appointed by the King of England. So our government, our state government, was really an offshoot of the British government.
All right. So now we get to a point where we, as a Commonwealth of Massachusetts, then a colony, were so dedicated, we'd put two of these up, right? This sacred cod. And I'm assuming the sacred dimension, Steve, probably harkens back to our Puritan roots mm-hmm. as well. Bart Tachi, our producer, pulled a quote from Samuel Eliot Morison, 1922. He's a historian that said, Puritan Massachusetts derived her ideals from a sacred book, her wealth and power from the sacred cod. So how do we wind up with a third 5-foot wooden sculpture of a fish?
Well, you know, it's like, well, we've always had this cod, and, you know, the first one burned down, the second one was stolen by the Redcoats, we need a new cod. So they created a new cod, and that one hung in the old state house for a period of time. And then when the new state house, the Bullfinch Front, which was built in the late 1790s, I believe it opened up in 1798, the new Massachusetts legislature under the new Massachusetts Constitution, which was founded in 1780, was the Massachusetts Constitution. Of course, you had independence in 1776 in the United States Constitution. So this is all new government. We've got this brand new building designed by Charles Bullfinch with the big dome on the top and everything. Let's move on up there and set up shop in the new state house. So if you know the front of the state house, the brick part, the chamber in the middle was the original house chamber. The room off to the side, which is now the Senate reading room, that was the Senate chamber. And then you had the governor's office and the governor's council, where it still is to this very day. So they moved that up. They brought the sacred cod that hung down at the old state house, hung it up in the new house chamber, and that's where it stayed for about 100 years.
Until
they built the Brigham edition of the State House, which was around 100 years later. So call it the late 1890s. They build the Brigham edition, which extends two blocks back from the front of the State House, and there's a new house chamber built there. So they build the new house chamber. The house members move out of their rather crowded chamber in the front, move to this much more spacious chamber in the back. And I am told, I've been the State House reporter for a long time, but I wasn't there then. Just to clear that up, I'm told that they went in and they said, hey, we cannot meet. We can't meet because we don't have the sacred cod. So some of the members found, because, you know, the place was still being built at that point, they found an old wheelbarrow, and they went back to the old chamber, which was going to become the Senate chamber and is now the Senate chamber. They went back to that. They took the cod down off of wherever it was hanging in there, had a little procession from the old house chamber
to the new. I'm picturing it with the wheelbarrow and everybody marching behind it.
I've heard this from Senator Bruce Tarr, who's the senator from Gloucester, and he says that one of his ancestors was one of the members that took part in this. So he's, you know, if you want to know more, you're talking to me. You want to talk to the expert. Senator Tarr come in. He'll tell you all about it because his family was involved with that moving the sacred cod to the current chamber, and that's where it hangs.
All right, let's do another lightning round.
Okay.
Does the Senate have a fish?
They do.
What's it called?
Developed a name. It is part of the chandelier. If you look at the chandelier that hangs over the Senate chamber, which is directly below the Golden Dome, if you draw a line right from the top of the Golden Dome straight through, it will come right through that chandelier into the Senate chamber. There is a codfish in there. But over the years, that codfish has developed the name the Holy Mackerel.
Because, of course. Okay, so a couple more quick questions on this. So why did we have a replica of the actual sacred cod marching through the streets of Boston last week, wrapped in a Revolutionary War era flag with a drum and fife corps?
Yeah, that was to replicate the moving of the sacred cod from the old State House down on State Street up to the new State House, which is over 225 years old. Only in Boston do you have the new State House.
It's 225. And it was to mark that 225,
yes.
Right? Do we do that like every quarter century?
I don't know. I was around 25 years ago. I don't recall. They have processions and things like that. Unfortunately, I was working on another story in the office, and I heard these fifes and drums and what have you, and I was tied up with what I was doing. And then by the time I went out into the hall to see what was going on, they'd vanished.
All right, we're talking about the legend of the sacred cod here with WBUR Senior State House reporter Steve Brown. Let's talk about fish thievery, because in the 20th century, I find this just a little interesting anecdote. This cod is all a way for us to understand Boston history. Mm-hmm. So tell us about the thievery that happened in the 1900s.
Yeah, you know, there were college pranks. It was the Harvard students took the cod in 1933. And kidnapped it or codnapped it, as you said earlier in the introduction. And so, eventually, at the time, as is now, there's a lot of connections between the legislature and Harvard.
But people went up in arms, right?
Oh, Steve, yeah.
Like, it was a big deal. They dredged at the Charles River
They did. And, it eventually somebody, came clean and said, all right, here's the thing. They came back. I guess some of its fins were damaged. So they had to fix that. I'm aware also of another situation where it was stolen more of as a political protest. Some UMass Boston students wanted more funding for the school, so they were able to get in there and take it. Happy to say now, I think it's pretty safe there. They keep the chamber locked up. Where it hangs at the back of the chamber. But if you are in the gallery, in the visitor's gallery to observe, You're basically looking right at it. That's as close as you can get to it. Now, if anybody tried to get up there, I think the court officers, the House court officers would quickly bring you to justice and not allow that sacred cod to be snatched again.
So last question for you, Steve Brown. Anything else like the sacred cod in the State House or in Massachusetts history that we should know about?
One of my favorite things, and this may have come up a couple of weeks ago when Charlie Baker did his lone walk out of the State House. It's the front doors of the State House, the front doors leading into Doric Hall. If you go up the granite steps, which are always locked now, this is an offshoot of 9/11. Security. They had to buckle down and only have a couple of public entrances to the State House. When I first started going there in the 80s, I can walk up Beacon Street. The gates to the front of the State House were open, and you could walk up the granite steps, but you couldn't go in the very front door. The front door right in the center. You had to go either off to the left or the right. Those doors were open, and you could go into the State House. Those doors. Into Doric Hall. The center doors are only opened when a governor is leaving the State House for the last time, like Charlie Baker did a couple of weeks ago, or if a visiting head of state comes, they will open the doors and the governor will go and greet them and bring them in through the main door.
All right, WBUR Senior State House reporter Steve Brown there. Thank you, Steve.
That was fun.
With our next guest's help, we have been regularly diving into the world of comics and culture around them. Here on the show, here on Radio Boston, Joel Christian Gill is the inaugural chair of the Boston University MFA program in visual narrative, and he's been our guide into the world of comics. He's back for a special edition of Comic Culture today. Welcome back, Joel.
Thanks for having me.
Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year.
So you brought a guest here in Studio 2 with you, Lissa Kramer, who is Director of Galleries at Boston University. Welcome to the show, Lissa.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And we're going to be talking about an exhibit at BU, so I'm just going to note for full disclosure that BU holds WBUR's broadcast license as well. So I will get to you in a minute, Joel, but I'm actually going to start with you, Lissa.
Uh-oh.
You worked with Joel on this comic exhibit. And so I have two questions for you. These are fill in the blanks. Before you started working on this exhibit, you thought comics were...
for children.
Okay. And now that you have worked on this exhibit, you think comics are...
for everyone.
Joel, react.
I win. Yeah. Mischief managed.
Yeah. All right, so tell us how the two of you started to come to work together, Joel.
So Harvey Young, our dean, wanted to do a comic exhibition, and he reached out to me. And then Lissa reached out to me, and I started thinking about, I had done a similar exhibition when I was at another school, and I said, we should do this bigger. And when I was thinking about this process and like all of the stuff that we could put in, I was like, oh, this is going to be too hard. This is going to be too difficult. And Lissa was just like, she tapped my hand. She goes, Joel, just don't worry about it. Let's just figure it out. We can do it. And I was like, okay, so let's go all out. So I legitimately started thinking about, how people typically view comics. As we've talked about before, comics has been superheroes or funny kids in the newspaper. But in reality, comics are not that. Comics are a medium, not a genre. And so that's the name of the show. Comics are a medium, not a genre. And what that means is when you think about comics, people typically associate it with superheroes or newspaper funnies. And so we have superheroes and newspaper funnies, but we also have Alison Bechdel's Fun Home. We also have... Grass Green, who was one of the first black underground cartoonists. We have a whole slew of works from an underground publisher named Dennis Kitchen. We have Swamp Thing. We have Superman. We have all these different comics to basically show that comics are, as Scott McCloud said in Understanding Comics, comics are the picture in which you put the liquid in. They are not the liquid. So if you put Kool-Aid in that liquid, it's for everybody. It's for kids. It's for everybody. But if you put sangria in it, it's not for kids unless you're a bad parent.
Okay, so I did not see that one coming. I liked it a lot. So I'll come back to you now, Lissa. So we have this exhibit. It opens tomorrow at Boston University. Most people don't even know can't picture an exhibit, and most of us don't know how one gets put together. So what is it exactly that you do?
Oh, well, in this case, I did all of the paperwork.
It's riveting.
Yeah. A lot of my job takes place behind a computer, and I would say about 10% is the stuff that people think I actually do with the hanging of the art, selecting the art. In this case, I got lucky. I'm not an expert in the field of comics. Joel is our expert, so I got to defer to him quite a bit. He came up with our checklist, and I told him to dream big. And then I regretted saying that. I didn't know what I was asking. But he did. He came up with the checklist. We have over 100 different pieces in the show. He gave me that checklist, and then I
went out and got
made
him
happen.
Yeah. And the paperwork is because in this, I can't decide if I'm supposed to be embarrassed to admit this or not, but I'm not embarrassed, and I'm just going to admit it. I didn't realize that for an exhibit like this, you have to borrow a lot from people, like private collections and things like that?
Yes.
So talk about that.
Yes. So many of our exhibitions are loaned exhibitions. We don't have our own collection at the BU Art Gallery, so most of the works that we bring in are from private collections or different museums, from museum collections. In this case, we have, I believe we have 40 lenders, and of those lenders, we've got the Library of Congress, that's actually going in today. We've got the Gottlieb Library.
Wait, what's from the Library of Congress?
Oh, we've got, I think, 8 works.
Can you name one?
We've got the very first Charlie Brown comic, which is incredible. We've got Alison Bechdel's Dykes to Watch Out For. We got pages from that. We have Gasoline Alley, Frank King. We've got Crazy Cat. These are all like Hearst, like comics from the 1890s. We've got Crazy Cat. We've got Yellow Kid, which are like foundational American comics. Like those things are from the Library of Congress. And it's like, I'm just like thinking about it, it like gives me chills. They're like amazing to see these things in real life.
And a couple of the other places you've got parts of the collection from.
Right. We've got private lenders. The Gottlieb Library just down the street on our own campus has a collection of comics that they're loaning to us as well. So we've got a Little Orphan Annie coming.
Little Orphan Annie.
There's a few mainstream comics that are coming
Al Cap. I think Al Cap. Yeah.
That are coming from our own institution. So it's pretty exciting.
So, Joel, now that I listen about this, right, and I'm learning about it, I have a couple questions for you. And the first is, how did you know what was out there to get? Like, you have this checklist, and is it, oh, we have to get one of these and one of these and one of these specifically? And how did you know where they'd be and who has them? Or is it more, we got to get a type of this and a type of this, and then you just go sniffing and see what you can find?
Well, originally I had conceived of the idea to have different sections of the work. So there's like women in comics, BIPOC comics, mainstream comic, alternative press, queer comics, and we were going to have like these sections. But I thought it would be more integrated to have everybody in the same place. And so with that, I had a list of like the people that I thought would be good. And
so you really went from the artist.
Yeah, I went from the artist standpoint. And so like reaching out to, you know, if I think about like who, and we have people who've written for it, like Hillary Chute, who's a professor at Northeastern, wrote about women in comics. Dan Mazur, who's a cartoonist in Boston, in Cambridge, and he wrote about comics of the world, and he loaned us a bunch of stuff. And so it was sort of like thinking about, like, these are the categories, and how do we get enough stuff in all those categories so that we can make sure that the show is very diverse? We've got, you know, every type of comic you can think of is in the show. And the way in which I think about this, and I told Lissa this as well when we were hanging the show, and I was like, I want people to walk into the gallery and there be an explosion of comics. Mm. And we've got some, like, one of the things about the Gottlieb, I just want to like really like yell about this, is that we have a letter from a cartoonist named Frederick Opper, who was an American cartoonist who started in Europe. And then he wrote about how comics in America was different than Europe. And he writes this foundational letter that they actually have in the Gottlieb, and I'm so excited about it. And so that letter is in the show as well, this handwritten letter about like the difference between European comics and American comics. And this was one of the like fathers of how comics are made in the United States. And so he comes over and he talks about like the difference between panel borders and word balloons and like the working in the process and like the fight between Pulitzer and the Hearst newspapers. It's really fascinating.
So the Pulitzer Pritzker and Hearst fight included over comics.
Oh, yeah. They would throw money at people. That's how most superheroes were created. Like, somebody would create a superhero, and then they would say, they would throw money at him and say, make me a Superman. And so then you get, you know, the Phantom, or you'd get Batman, or you get, like, they would just throw money at people, right? Or they would throw money and say, I want you to steal this idea and do it. And they would, like, fight back and forth, and they would throw money at cartoonists. I wish they would throw money at cartoonists now. It'd be amazing.
All right. That. So, Lissa, I'll come back to you, and we're speaking with Joel Christian Gill and Lissa Kramer about Comics is a Medium, Not a Genre, which is an exhibit that's opening at Boston University tomorrow. What is the most far, boy, that's grammatically incorrect, and yet I'm going to say it. The most farthest flung comic in the exhibit. How far did you go?
Ooh.
Japan? We've got manga from the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, I got to say that the world comic section is pretty diverse. There's we've got some French comics out there.
South America.
And then Agardo's got the Puerto Rican superhero.
Whose name I'm going to butcher, but I'm not going to say it.
we really stretched out. And this is the first exhibition that I've ever done where Joel, the curator, asked the artists themselves to submit their own work, to submit what they would like.
So you invited a self-nomination, basically,
yeah.
Joel.
So what I would do is I'd send people messages like, I would say, I would really like to have some of this work, but if you feel something else is better, that's okay. So like a friend of mine, Whit Taylor, I asked her for specifically work from one of her books, and she was like, well, I just loaned it to somebody else. Can you take this? And so that would be the case. Or people would typically send stuff from like whatever their, you know, most acclaimed work, like Nate Powell, who's the cartoonist who drew March. He sent pages from March, which are incredible. And so he sent some pages from March, but he also sent a page from his new book, Save It for Later, right? So, like, we had people just guess, like, basically saying, here's what I'd like to have. I'd say, here's what I'd like to have. And they'd say, here's what I have. And most of the time they sent what I'd like to have.
So are graphic novels there as well, represented as well?
So comics and graphic novels are the same thing?
Yeah, well, and we have talked about that.
Yeah.
But the reason that I ask is that for our listeners still,
yeah.
right, like Fights, your graphic novel, which is the first time I ever talked to you
right.
on air, right? I'm assuming, did you put pages from Fights in
I did
there?
Not.
You did not! Okay, I'm going to scold you for
I
that.
Asked multiple times if he would submit work, and he
Why
said
not?
No.
Why?
Well, I did drawings for I did drawing cartoons of all the people who wrote for something in the show. So they're like my work is in the show. I don't know. I just felt like it was pretentious to put my own work
put your
in
own
there.
Stuff
like
in there.
I just didn't want to do that. I felt bad about it.
So we have talked before about graphic novels and comics being the same thing, and yet still for many people, just like when we started with you, Lissa, and I said, "What did you think?" Fill in the blank for kids now for everybody. The form. Right? The form is much broader than what we understand in our basic conceptions. And as I want people to picture when they walk in and they get this cacophony of comics, right?
A cacophony of comics. That's the word.
Do
there.
You like it?
Yes.
All the different forms that it can come in. And this is the other thing. There are people behind everything in this collection. And Joel, you've told us a little bit about some of the artists. And I'm curious about the collectors. Did you meet Lissa or Joel, any collectors who particularly struck you or their collections did or the way they feel about these comics?
Dennis Kitchen.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So tell us.
Absolutely.
Dennis is a great, he's an underground cartoonist. He had a press called Kitchen Sink Press. I called him because I knew he was in the area and I'm like, you know, I'd love to see some of the work. He was like, why don't you just come down here? And so I go to his house, and I'm completely overwhelmed. His house is completely filled with comics. He has Harvey Kurtzman's collection, Howard Cruz's collection, Wills Eisner's collection, because he's the executor of their estates. Howard Cruz was the first openly gay cartoonist, one of the first openly gay cartoonists. Will Eisner created The Spirit, and Harvey Kurtzman was one of the founders of Mad Magazine. He has, like, figure drawings from Harvey Kurtzman in, like, a flat file. And then his house is just like a museum. And then he has this, like, crazy thing, which I'll talk about at the side. It's called the Valley of the Dolls behind his house, where he's created this, like, this incredible, like, sculpture that you walk through that's made of dolls. And so Lissa's like, I'm going to Dennis's house. I hope I don't die.
And how did it strike you the first time you went?
it's overwhelming in a good way. Like Joel mentioned, you're surrounded by comics, you're swallowed up by them, and then, of course, going out to his special sculptural walk. Dennis said to me, he's like, well, why don't you go ahead and you can set the pace? And I'm like, oh, you're going to be behind me. No, I know how this is going to end. But, you know, it's...
I should ask, does Dennis have a sense of humor about this?
Dennis is great. He is fantastic. Yeah. I can't say enough things about Dennis.
But Dennis, his whole house, it's all magical in a comics way. And several of our lenders, this is one of the rare times I got to go pick up the works myself. Normally the works are too big and I have to have them delivered. So I got to meet the lenders. I got to meet some of the artists, and everyone was so welcoming and lovely. And every comic artist wants to tell you about their work. So you learn as you're going. So it was an incredible experience.
So the exhibit is comics as a medium, not a genre. Joel, that moment you saw in person for the first time, and the heavens opened up and the light came down and you heard, oh, right? What was that piece of art?
Which one is that? I don't know. There's so many. To single one out would be incredible. Dean Kamen sent some of his father's work. He sent it from Manchester, Jack Kamen's work, and he did a book called, he worked for EC Comics in the 50s, and so he sent Orphan, which was one of the comics that started the process of banning books in the 1950s.
Why? So, what kind of subject matter?
Because it was at the time in the 1950s, we got a few more minutes. In the 1950s, comics were started to look at as like not for, they're marketing toward kids when they shouldn't be.
Got it.
And they were looking at comics not as like books, but like these are kids' things. And so that meant we can talk about this another time, we get the Comics Code Authority, we get self-censorship, Batman gets Robin, Captain America gets Bucky, we start making comics for kids, and in Europe it's something different. But Orphan is a story about like a murder. And it's one of those things that spark all of these congressional hearings in the 1950s. And so why all these comics are banned now. It's also one of the reasons why we have the term graphic novel in comics. Why Mad Magazine is called Magazine and not Comics, because they wanted to distance themselves from the floppy comics. They wanted to get away from that. Like, I'm doing something different so that I'm not demonized or put in the same basket, so that we don't have to fall under the same censorship rules. So Orphan is one of those books those stories that was in EC Comics in the 1950s that I think is foundational.
All right. And Lissa, last question to you. So now comics are for everyone. Are you reading comics?
Oh, I don't have a choice. Joel has already given me a list. I have to catch up.
All right. Lissa Kramer is the director of galleries at Boston University. Joel Christian Gill is the inaugural chair of the BU MFA program in visual narrative. The exhibit is Comics is a Medium, Not a Genre. It runs from January 19th to March 24th. And you can find more on our website at radioboston.org. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, thanks.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.